Welcome to the podcast that is all about self-employment. We'll be sharing expertise on getting started, getting noticed, and getting it right, as well as dealing with getting it wrong. Your host, Julia Kermode, will help you get ahead so you get the success you deserve.
Welcome to today's podcast. I'm delighted to be joined by Rebecca Seeley-Harris, and we're talking about self-employment and employers that may want you to work for them on a self-employed basis. Now, Rebecca is an expert in this field. She has a legal consultancy, which she set up some 20 years ago or thereabouts. And she specialises in employment status, covering stuff around tax in terms of IR35, off-payroll working, and anything to do with employment status, the gig economy, self-employed people working through personal service companies. I mean, the list is endless and it's a massive topic. But importantly, Rebecca was seconded to the Office of Tax Simplification, which is an independent body within the government. And she was a senior policy advisor there, set up to advise the government on employment and tax status. And she reported directly into the Chancellor. So we're really privileged to have such an expert joining us today. So, I've known Rebecca for a number of years. So really warm welcome, Rebecca. Is there anything you want to add to that intro?
Thank you. That's very kind.
Well, we're just delighted to have someone with your level of expertise joining us. So I've already kind of outlined the scenario that we want to talk about today. And I am aware that there are a few businesses out there that are requiring workers to work for them on a self-employed basis. And a number of these workers have previously been employees, and now their bosses are essentially saying, if you want to keep working for me, you have to do it on a self-employed basis. So, Rebecca, what is wrong with that scenario in your view?
Well, there's several different reasons. I think probably the reason why they're doing it is because of the tax position. But the main thing is that if you have the characteristics of an employee, you can't then be asked to be self-employed because they are two different employment statuses. When I say employment status, I probably should just give a brief explanation that employment status is just the name that covers your status for tax purposes and for employment rights purposes. So it is whether you are employed or self-employed. So it's not really the for the employer to make that choice, but you know, if they are, it's probably for cost saving reasons. And it will unfortunately deny you employment rights if you are self-employed.
Okay, and in terms of the cost savings for the employer, we're talking about employers' national insurance contributions as well as tax deductions, aren't we?
You're also talking about all the benefits, pensions, possibly national minimum wage. So there are a lot of savings, which is probably why the employer is doing it. I think also that the employer is now required to contribute to the furlough scheme. The employer's national insurance. So on furlough, they're still having to pay 13.8%. And obviously, you know, in a global pandemic, unfortunately, these businesses are having to do whatever they can to keep the businesses going. And I guess somebody's made the decision that their workforce would be better off as self-employed. If they do make that decision, then they need to be cautioned that the job role has to be substantially different, and it has actually have to have the criteria of self-employment.
Yeah, so that's a really important point, because some people kind of think that they can decide their employment status, but it's not actually down to an individual decision, really. It's about kind of looking at the characteristics of how they're working, and kind of, can you talk us through that a little bit?
Ultimately it's the courts that decide. On a day-to-day basis, you are supposed to know the characteristics of being self-employed. So if you decide for yourself that you want to be self-employed, then from a tax point of view, HMRC requires that you understand it. Mm-hmm. But if HMRC decided to challenge, then it would go to a tribunal and a court. And there are various court cases ongoing at the moment.
So, Rebecca, in terms of employment rights, for someone that's self-employed, they don't have any minimum rights such as minimum wage or holiday or anything like that, do they?
Employment rights are given to the employee, but the benefits come from the national insurance contribution. So they are denied both. So as a self-employed person, they do get certain benefits, but they suddenly wouldn't get the same level of benefits or rights as a self-employed person. Okay. Although if we look at the category of worker, this is where it gets complicated. So in employment rights, you've got an employee, a self-employed person, and something called a LIMBY worker. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the LIMBY worker category, they do get basic employment rights, which would include national minimum wage. And they're sort of like an intermediate category. Mm-hmm. A lot of the court cases in the gig economy have been based around workers' rights.
Yeah. So if someone is working for a company on a self-employed basis, but they think they should be an employee, can they then challenge their employer for those worker rights?
Yes, absolutely. They would need to take action within 3 months.
Right.
So within 3 months of the event taking place, they would need to put in an ET1 into the tribunal and make their case. It's an unusual circumstance because you would either be making your case as an employee. Mm. So would it be unfair dismissal if you've got more than 2 years service? Or if you are then self-employed, you would have to make the court decide whether you should have been employed or self-employed or in fact a worker. So it really would be best getting some kind of advice either from Citizens Advice Bureau or ACAS. Yeah. Because it really depends on your sort of route to challenge the employer what you're trying to get out of it, I suppose.
Yeah, okay. I think some people who are going from being an employee to a self-employed role within the same company, they need to kind of probably bear in mind whether the role has changed or not, because often going from an employed role to a self-employed role, doing the same thing, that is one of the reasons why HMRC brought in IR35 yeah. legislation, which we're not going to go into in too much detail because we've already covered it on a different episode within this podcast. But yeah, that in itself can be an indicator that it's a sham arrangement, can't it?
Yeah, I mean, we have to be slightly careful because a sham arrangement is actually a legal issue okay. itself, and they aren't necessarily sham arrangements. There was a case about 10 years ago, actually, which was Auto Cleanse, which was a load of car validators, and the court decided that it wasn't a sham arrangement, but it was not representative of the real situation. So the employer had engaged these people as self-employed, but they were in fact doing the job as somebody who was employed. And there's loads of characteristics of employment and of self-employment. And that's how the court decides.
Yeah, okay. And thanks for correcting me on the sham arrangement. This is why I love having legal people on, because it picks me up on slight errors, and it's fantastic because we need to be accurate in these podcasts.
So the trouble is, as a lawyer, you've got to be really technically accurate. And sometimes I feel like I'm being really picky.
No, you can be picky with me. It's absolutely fine. I'm very happy for that. So in terms of kind of characteristics of self-employment, then what are the main characteristics that someone would need in order to be genuinely self-employed?
There are various different areas, and I'm sure the first one that most people come up with is that you have to have your own equipment. That's very true. Obviously, if you're running your business, which is essentially what it is, you should be providing all the sort of trade hallmarks of being in business. So you have your own equipment. I mean, these days, with a lot of these sort of skilled positions, a laptop is the only thing that you have. But very often the engager or the employer will supply you with a laptop, which is an indication that you're not self-employed. So you should be providing your own equipment. And you should also have control over your time. So if the employer is asking you to still come in to the office or to whatever. I mean, obviously nowadays it's very, very different. The whole employment landscape because of working from home. Mm. But ordinarily as a self-employed person, you would have your own office, for example. Yeah. You would control when and where you do the work. And also one of the most important points of being in control is that you are the person that decides how the job is done. Now, if you've been moved from being an employee to being self-employed, it's likely that the employer is going to continue to exert that control, which is a very strong pointer towards employment and not self-employment. And there's various other sort of indicators like financial risk. Are you able to make a profit out of the work that you do? You know, have you got a website? Have you got business cards? yeah. You know, all those kinds of things. So I should imagine those people who are being de-employed, however they are being de-employed, whether it's redundancy. And actually, that's an interesting question, is how are the employers de-employing these people? How are they going to actually move them from employment to self-employment? Because if it's redundancy and they're going back in to do the same job, then it's not, the job's not redundant.
That's
another legal question that for an employment lawyer, because I'm not entirely sure on that. But again, you know, the responsibility there is with the employer.
Yeah.
So the self-employed person can take them to a tribunal to enforce their rights on employment rights.
Yeah, so if it turns out that the self-employed person is actually a worker or an employee at the end of the tribunal, who would pay kind of any tax that would be owed to the government on that position? Because obviously if they've been working self-employed, then they will have kept all of their income and paid tax as a self-employed person at the end of the year. So presumably there's employment costs for the employer then at the end of the day, yeah, rather than the self-employed person.
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange situation because the employer, although they're saving on the employer's national insurance and pensions and benefits, at the end of the day, they're going to be liable.
So basically, the employer would be at risk of a bill from HMRC potentially, depending on...
Or from the employee. So, I mean, it's a risky position to take. I can understand, in theory, why they might think at this moment in time it would be helpful, but... I wouldn't advise it in the long term. I think it's you know, it's a very risky position. I mean, obviously, when I'm working with clients, I'm working with clients to try and ensure that their workforce is in fact self-employed. So you have to do a lot of, you know, the engager has to put in a lot of hard work, both contractually and from a working practices point of view, to make sure that their workforce are actually self-employed. So these employers who are de-employing people to make them self-employed probably won't have made all those changes.
No.
There would be a separate contract, and that contract would be also dependent on whether you are self-employed or a worker. So it's not as simple as maybe the employer thinks.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess also we have seen some cases where someone has been working as self-employed, but they then are, the courts establish they're either a worker or an employee in terms of employment status. And then the business that they've been working for then has to pay them for holiday or other kind of benefits that they should have had, but they haven't in that time working for them.
So I mean, actually, I had an interesting question the other day about rolled up holiday pay.
Okay.
Because if you're a worker or an employee, as an employee, you'll probably just get your holiday. But as a worker, it's possible that some companies are using the technique of rolled up holiday pay, which means that you're paid the holiday pay rather than having to being required to actually take the time off. The interesting thing with that is that came from a decision in Europe from the European Court, and the UK hasn't actually brought that legislation into force. And of course, now we're in a state of flux where we've left Europe.
Yeah.
We don't know what the European law is. So for the worker, if the employer is de-employing this employee and making them self-employed, but they took a challenge that they were actually a worker, there's all sorts of holiday pay issues.
Yeah,
but the employer would at the end of the day be liable, and I strongly suspect in this situation that the characteristics of that individual having worked as an employee, and that's something that HMRC would ask, you know, were you previously employed by the same person? Well, all those would weigh against the employer. So although, you know, it is in one sense good for the self-employed person that they get paid without deductions, they do have to make sure that they register and that they pay their own taxes, but they're not going to be ultimately responsible for the tax at the end of the day.
Okay. Well, that's kind of useful. So really the main risk is with the business that they're working for rather than them individually. I guess that because they don't have minimum rights, then they are at risk of not being paid the minimum wage and that sort of thing. One of the things you said about the difference between being employed and self-employed was this kind of level of control that a self-employed person has. And I think it's very helpful for listeners to really get to grips with that, because basically it means that they can choose not to do the work. It means that they wouldn't get paid, but they can choose not to do the work, or they can choose to do the work as and when they want, not necessarily when the business they're working for might want them to do it. If that makes sense, if I haven't confused everyone.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's the thing is with employment status is that it is a really, really complex area. And it also depends on whether it's for a tax point of view or whether it's from an employment rights point of view.
Yeah.
It may also be from a personal injury point of view, actually. There's also other reasons why you might be challenging your employment status. But the main indicia, I suppose, as they call it, is... at the top there would be the control issue, as you know, are you able to control your own time? I should imagine in this circumstance that there won't be very much difference between how you worked as an employee and how you worked as self-employed. There's also something that has got a very strange legal title, which is mutuality of obligations.
Yeah.
And that is something that even the experts disagree on. and all the experts, I think, probably disagree with HMRC on their view of what this mutuality is. It's very basically, if I can try and describe it.
Yes.
Whether your employer has a duty to pay you, and whether you have a duty or an obligation, in fact, to do the work. Now that sounds very simple, but you know, the legal technicalities of it make it more complicated. But one of the points that would work in your favour as a self-employed person would be whether you can substitute yourself or not. So the whole point is that do you have to do the services personally, or can you put someone else in your place to do those services for you? If that is the case, and I should imagine in this situation, unless the employer is aware of all these employment status indicia, that probably wouldn't be the case. And that has been one of the main points in a lot of the case law that's come up, the substitution issue and the mutuality issue. So it is a very complex legal area. So it's not quite as simple, but I think the employee, unfortunately, is in a situation, as you said at the beginning, during a global pandemic of what do you do if you want to earn money?
Yes, and ultimately, I think some listeners may find themselves in a position where they decide to accept a self-employed role, even if they don't really think it is genuinely self-employed, just so that they can have some income. And I completely understand that. And I guess in that situation, that's their decision to make, and it's their decision as to whether they want to challenge their employment status. And I think you said at the start they have 3 months to lodge that challenge with the courts. That's correct, isn't it?
Yeah. You've got 3 months from the point of the action. And again, this depends on whether you're taking action as a wrongly treated employee, or whether you're challenging your status as a self-employed person. And that's something that you need to get advice on.
Yeah. And I think you suggested Citizens Advice Bureau for that type of advice, which is helpful. We mentioned HMRC and their view on mutuality of obligations, which is a characteristic of employment. Just thinking of HMRC, they do have a check employment status for tax online tool. Now, we're not going to get into the tax side of things, or we'll try not to. But just briefly for our listeners, do you think it would be worth someone in this position going to HMRC's online tool and just seeing whether the characteristics of what they're doing might be akin to employment rather than self-employment?
Yeah, I mean, there's 2 points to make with the CEST tool, the Check Employment Status for Tax. First of all, it is used for tax purposes, not for employment rights purposes. But I think if you used it, then you have got an indication of what HMRC think that your status is. So even though it is for tax status, and it can be used for the self-employed, as I think probably at the moment people think because of there's a piece of legislation that's coming in April, which applies only to limited companies. This legislation that used to be called IR35 is now called off-payroll working. So CEST is being predominantly used for that, but it is still usable by the self-employed person. by the worker and by the client. So it is a very good indication for both parties of finding out what HMRC would think. And if I can just mention, I have just written a book on this called CEST Explained, because it is a very, very complicated set of questions that are highly biased towards HMRC, but it is HMRC's tool. So the point is that it replaces the live inspector, if you like, into a digital tool, which obviously a lot of people are doing these days.
Yeah.
But it is a fairly complicated and convoluted tool that you need to understand why they're asking the question to answer it accurately. And if you do answer it accurately, then HMRC says that they will stand by the output. So I think it's probably a useful tool in your toolkit, but it's not something that you can solely rely on.
Okay. And I will put the reference to your book in the notes that go with this podcast episode, because then anyone who's interested can then find it. But I think from the last time I looked at the tool, which is going back a bit now, there's probably about 50 or so questions, and they look at all of these different characteristics, but with a view of determining tax status, as you say, not employment status.
It is quite similar to what the courts would be looking for in employment rights as well. So they do use the same case law. And I don't think we've mentioned actually that employment status is entirely based on case law. There are no statutory tests, unfortunately. Although actually when I was at the Office of Tax Simplification, we carried out an employment status review to see if we could simplify. In fact, the CEST tool came out of a recommendation that was made that the previous tool, the Employment Status Service, the ESS, or the ESI, I think it was also called, wasn't fit for purpose. So this is why CEST came about.
Just interested in what you were saying when you were at the Office of Tax Simplification and you were looking at whether employment status can be simplified. And obviously the conclusion was perhaps that it can't be simplified. Was that broadly what was found?
No, we came up with a lot of recommendations, actually, so how it works is that we're an independent review body.
Yeah.
And we work with the Financial Secretary to the Treasury, who then was David Gawke, I think, is now Jesse Norman. Yeah. And we work with the FST in the recommendations that then go to the Chancellor. Mm. The recommendations were accepted. A lot of them were accepted. But unfortunately, then Brexit happened. The project kind of stalled. So I'm hoping now, I mean, else now we've got Brexit and now COVID. So there's a lot of employment status points going on. The Taylor Review.
Yes.
Which was a review into good working practices, which I really hope the government is going to take up the recommendations from that, because that does protect those people in the gig economy. Mm. And this is essentially what we're talking about, the gig economy, because a lot of employers are de-employing or de-engaging the individual and making them self-employed. Although, interestingly, there's one example from Hermes, which has a hybrid solution where their workers are self-employed, but they have, in fact, given them minimum employment rights. So they are technically, I suppose, a LIMBY worker.
I think Hermes might have been one of the companies that was offering people the choice. I'm sure I've read about it, a career firm who was offering their workers, do you want to be self-employed? And then we will pay you in this way with these types of bonuses. Do you want to be a worker? And, you know, and offering them the option. And I thought that was a really positive way forward, providing the worker makes that informed choice and they're not forced into one or the other. If it is a genuine choice, I thought that was really positive.
I think that's the really important point, is actually that the worker is looked after, because we've seen a lot of situations where individuals actually have been forced into incorporating a limited company.
Right.
And these are people who really shouldn't be in limited companies. So, you know, you might be the sort of the unskilled end, where a limited company is not appropriate at all. But some companies were, and this is because it avoids tax and employment rights. But the laws are all changing now. So the playing field has been leveled, if you like, by HMRC. So even if you're working through a limited company or self-employed, the responsibility is on the employer or the engager for tax point of view if HMRC challenged it. But it is still up to the worker or the individual to challenge for their employment rights.
Okay, and that's useful. And just where you're saying about sometimes self-employed people forced to work through their own limited company, I always think it's worth pointing out that if you're opening a limited company to work through, you are a director of that limited company, and therefore you have legal obligations yourself, don't you?
You do, actually. And interesting, as I'm sure you're aware of in this in the pandemic, that unfortunately those people who did incorporate as a director, they are not then able to claim any government support. So the self-employed were able to claim self-employed income support scheme. But the directors of the limited companies have had absolutely no support. And, you know, that is the problem with the system at the moment, is that it's a bit broken, to be honest, because there are too many different categories and there are not enough employment protections. In my view, there needs to be a lot more initiative from the government to make sure that these people in the gig economy are protected from the schemes or the, you know, structures that their engager might set up.
Yes, I think that's a really good point. And you mentioned before about Matthew Taylor's review that resulted in the Good Work Plan. And on all of this is kind of common themes in discussions within the government within the last, I mean, I've been in this sector 7 years, and there's kind of a recognition there that almost a whole scale review is needed. I really hope that something like that does happen. And I was looking yesterday about the Good Work Plan that Matthew Taylor did and the recommendations that he put forward. And I think there were, 60 recommendations. The government accepted most of them, but most haven't actually been translated into legislation. As you said, we had Brexit, we've now got the pandemic. But I've got my fingers crossed that now we're kind of hoping to be towards the end of both of those, that perhaps we might get this stuff looked at this year. I mean, do you think that's likely?
Well, I'm certainly going to be pushing for more reviews of this subject because I cover both the tax and the employment rights view.
Yeah.
And also having been a senior policy advisor and involved in the various different reviews, I'm very well aware of the inadequacies of the system. Yeah. I think this pandemic has really shown the fragility, if you like, of the position of some people, you know. So there's a lot of people who've been left out of support, and they are in an awful situation.
Yeah.
One situation I do know of is the PAYE freelancer, which is, they identify themselves as self-employed, as a freelancer, but in some roles they're being paid on payroll, but they get no employment rights. Which is a strange system.
Good. And just on this subject, it's worth noting all the huge amounts of work you're doing to try and push for a particular support solution, if you like, for these kind of excluded people who haven't had any government support from the pandemic. So on behalf of all of them, I think there are something like 3 million excluded people. Massive thank you. And we're all watching very carefully and hoping that at some point the Chancellor will bring in some support specific for these people. And the proposal you've put forward is DIS, which stands for Directors Income Support Scheme.
It does, yes. I thought I'd go for a catchy title.
Well, DIS is fantastic. That's the thing. It's all about acronyms, and at least you can say that one as opposed to SAYS, which is Self-Employed Income Support or whatever. But massive thank you on behalf of everyone for all that work, because I know it's very time consuming for you, and fingers crossed. And I think it would be brilliant for it to come in. It's so long overdue, and I shouldn't really be getting political, but I am really frustrated it is an
important topic. You know, there are gaps in support, people who've been excluded. There's an all-party parliamentary group called Gaps in Support, which is the largest parliamentary group, and on Tuesday we had a meeting, and all the MPs, and I think there are about 30 or 40 on the call, voted unanimously cross-party to support the Directors Income Support Scheme. So that's, and there's also an early day motion. There's also a 10-minute rule. I don't really understand all the political stuff, but there's a lot of pressure. It depends on the government now.
Yeah, Yeah, and I think, well, certainly at the start of the pandemic in March last year, I didn't foresee it would still be kind of here now. And I think the length of time that people have gone without any financial support whatsoever is just unforgivable. But anyway, yeah. I mean, as I say, for saying I'm not being political, I then go and say something like that. So in terms of, just to kind of wrap things up, is there any kind of suggestions you would make for someone who is working self-employed, but they feel that they perhaps aren't self-employed and they're more akin to being a worker or an employee? What can they do on a practical level? So we mentioned the employment tribunal route. If someone wants to do that, how do they go about it?
Well, it is difficult if you're an individual, because a lot of these cases that have been brought have been either backed by a union. I think the DMB union have brought some of these cases.
Yes.
Because we don't have class action. So, you know, you could band together. And I think the Uber case was two Uber drivers.
Mm.
But it does cost money. And, you know, you can try and get pro bono support, which is support where a solicitor or a barrister would give their time for free. You can go to Citizens Advice. So you don't have to pay to go to tribunal.
Yes.
And you can put your ET1 in, but it depends on whether you are employed, then moving to self-employed, or whether you are self-employed and wanting to challenge your position. Mm-hmm. But what I would do is try and get advice from somewhere. But also, if you've got other colleagues that feel the same, then try and, you know, get together, form some kind of group. Yes, the interesting point about that is that even though the people who bring the cases, so in the case of Pimlico Plumbers, it was Mr. Smith. In the case of the Uber cases, the court will decide on their specific position, but that doesn't apply to the whole. Mm-hmm. So, for example, with Uber, you've got a lot of a huge workforce. I don't even know, is it hundreds of thousands? Massive. Something like that. So it doesn't necessarily automatically apply to then categorise every single worker.
Right.
So it would then be for the company to decide, actually, you know, if the court's decided this, then we better do something about it. But yeah. I think the first suggestion would be to Citizens Advice or ACAS and try and get some kind of support, or you can just put in your and you can represent yourself at tribunal. You don't necessarily have to have legal support.
Okay. And I think then also your point about whether any colleagues are in the same kind of working position, then you could kind of band together and kind of follow up a tribunal as a group. And therefore, if the courts find in one way for you as an individual, they'll find in the same way for the others in the same situation. And I think that's what you were saying, is that that if you haven't gone to court with the others, your other colleagues, then whatever result comes for you isn't necessarily automatically applicable, which is really important. And you know, your example of Uber, which is probably the best known employment status case, you're quite right. It doesn't mean that suddenly all Uber drivers are suddenly all workers. It just means those people who brought that case about. So really,
the important point about that is that not every individual is going to be in the same situation. So you might have one Uber driver who's also working for another service, Lyft, I think, maybe, if it's still going, I don't know.
Yeah.
So they might be doing other things, or might be working day in, day out for one company. Mm. And another individual might have a different situation. So you can't have a uniform decision. It's all based on the individual.
Yes, you're quite right. So they could be juggling several different pieces of gig economy work, or they might just be working for one. So, gosh, it's so complicated, isn't it?
Fascinating area.
I could talk to you all day. I've no idea how you lawyers stay on top of all of this case law either. You must be constantly monitoring to see what's going on.
Well, you know, I've got another shameless plug here. I've also created something called EST Update, where I go through all the case law, everything that comes up from government, anything on self-employment, to keep people updated, because it is so difficult.
Fantastic. Well, I will put the link to that as well in the notes. So any final words for our listeners?
I think really just make sure that you understand. And there is quite a lot of information from HMRC. So have a look at iWork and find out what your basic position is for being self-employed, or indeed an agency worker, or any kind of other kind of sort of employment status.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you so, so much for joining us today. I know you're incredibly busy, so we're really pleased that you could spare the time for it. And hopefully we can talk to you again at some point in the future when perhaps you're less busy. Who knows?
Well, thank you very much for having me in. And I'm appreciative of the opportunity to, you know, I like sharing the knowledge and making sure that the people who can't or don't understand this topic, that I can actually help in some way.
Yeah, it's so important, isn't it? There's so many misunderstandings. So, yeah, massively appreciate your time.
Thank you for listening to All About Self-Employment, hosted by Julia Kermode. For more information on today's discussion, please visit iwork.co.uk, where you can also join our growing community. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, then we would love you to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. We'll be back at the same time next week.